This book is a call for physicians, other healthcare professionals, and society to actively engage in the discussion of how to approach medical futility. That's according to a review in the Journal of the American Medical Association about a book entitled Wrong Medicine, Doctors, Patients, and Futile Treatment. A co-author of the book joins us in this edition of the Bioethics Channel, a production of the Center for Practical Bioethics. For more information about the center and its programs, visit practicalbioethics.org. practicalbioethics.org. Dr. Lawrence Snyderman is a professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. Dr. Snyderman, why a second edition of the book, and why now?
I was asked by the editor of our first edition at Johns Hopkins Press to go ahead and prepare a second edition. And after thinking about it, I realized that it was a good idea because several changes have occurred in the conceptual, legislative, judicial, and clinical areas. In terms of conception, Nancy Checker and I now think of medical futility and the outcomes to be measured not just in the ICU, but in the acute care hospital, because that's where most studies of outcomes are based. In other words, the success of any particular treatment is usually judged by discharge from the acute care hospital. So we were able to kind of expand that notion. In terms of legislature, several things had happened, and most particularly in Texas. The Texas Advanced Directive Act actually is the first state to provide physicians, safe harbor it's called, immunizing physicians who, after they go through the necessary procedures, which are kind of aimed at accommodating all the wishes of patients and physicians, and in the end, after everything has been tried, if the physician still considers the demands of the family or surrogate for futile treatment, and there's no recourse, then the Texas Advanced Directive Act immunizes physicians against any legal jeopardy for withdrawing what they regard as non-beneficial or futile treatment. And other areas are working on that. There's the Uniform Health Decisions Act that many states have signed on to, which is the same sort of thing, a legislative indication that doctors and hospitals are not obligated to provide of what is professionally considered to be inappropriate treatment, even though it's demanded. And then, partly through my own work and the work of others, communities have established what would be a community standard of practice, in that they have now written hospital policies that define medical futility according to the criteria that we wrote about. And this has all occurred since that book.
I couldn't help but think that when it comes to medical futility, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It just becomes more expensive, and advancing medical technology makes things more complicated. Fair to say?
Yeah, in other words, you're right. Once we establish the notion that, the notion of patient autonomy does not mean patients or their surrogates can demand anything. Really they're assured of they can refuse anything, but the demands can get more and more complicated, and more expensive, and demands for prolonged intensive care, management of an unconscious patient or terminally ill patient. Yeah, that can still get worse and worse as all the technology we have, including, extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, ECMO, which came along after our first edition, which is very complicated and very expensive and also very resource-using, requires personnel for people who desperately wanted their loved ones to be kept alive.
Your book addresses a couple of concepts around medical futility, quantitative and qualitative. Explain that, if you would, please.
Yeah, thank you. That's an important notion. If you go back to the Hippocratic tradition, which in fact all modern Western medicine derives from, the Hippocratic school and the Hippocratic corpus, which provides all those instructions, says, look, if you try something over and over and over again and it doesn't work, at some point to continue it is allied with madness. And there's a famous saying attributed to many savants, including Einstein, that trying the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the definition of insanity. So one of the things that we try to say is, look, if you're trying to do CPR with the object of resuscitating the patient and having that patient successfully leave the hospital, look at the empirical data. And it turns out that there are certain medical conditions where it doesn't work in, you know, after it's been tried over 100 times. Wouldn't that be grounds for saying, okay, if something doesn't work, and you can pick any number, but, you know, we say, look, 1 in 100. If you show 100 times that it didn't work, and yeah, that doesn't mean there is no chance that it wouldn't work in the future, but it's no longer reasonable, and that you should remember the denominator. When you're attempting CPR, you're really doing a very burdensome, painful, and traumatic procedure in the hopes of maybe a rare event will occur. So that's the notion of quantitative futility. Qualitative futility is, even after you succeed, what are you left with? What does the patient have? And there again, attempting to resuscitate a patient with severe brain damage, as in the case of Terry Schiavo, what you're left with is a patient whose brainstem is still intact, but whose cerebral cortex has been destroyed. And so that person, for the rest of that person's life, will be unconscious. And so you have to say, you know, that's another goal that we have to keep in mind when we're beginning to assess whether or not we should do something or whether or not the treatment is futile.
A reality here, Dr. Schneiderman, is that doctors might be used to practicing in a certain way based on tradition, trying to avoid litigation, and the momentum of treatment, where it's hard to get off that treadmill.
Yeah, that's right. And you've certainly described a scenario that we've run into a lot, that physicians practice according to the way they were taught. Sometimes the data on which their teachings were based no longer support that kind of action. And that's why we have the notion of evidence-based medicine. I'm a very strong believer that we should work hard all the time to accumulate the best evidence with the best randomized controlled trials to really see whether the things we're doing are really beneficial. And so that's going to be a constant challenge in the future. There's also the fear of litigation. Doctors, and I remember when my student in internship days at the attending physician, you knew that the patient did not have any organic disease, but nevertheless insisted on all these invasive tests because the physician feared litigation, malpractice suits. And it turns out that 90% of the time, 90% of physicians admitted that they have sometimes done tests or done procedures to as a way to avoid malpractice risk, which is a bad way to practice medicine.
Do you think that your book is more important now that healthcare reform will be implemented over the next couple of years?
Oh, well, I would hope so. But right now, the healthcare debate is so far removed from healthcare. It's really a shame that, when people extreme death panels for the effort to allow physicians to be reimbursed for counseling patients about end of life. And when there's a big fight over whether to mandate health care insurance as opposed to letting it be voluntary, which would then, of course, destroy if people were able to opt out, all the healthy people would opt out, and that would just destroy the pool and make it impossible to fund. These are not health care or medical issues. These are political issues, and until we get through that, I hope my book will still be in print.
First edition in 1995, a second edition in 2012. Will you be around for a third edition?
I like to think that maybe I'm putting myself out of business. Now, the reason I'm saying that is because I started doing ethics consultations in the ICU, at least 20 years ago. And at that time, I would be talking to the residents and the faculty about, you know, these difficult problems. And they would kind of look at me and listen. And after a while, they would begin to say, you know, maybe you're making some sense. And now I don't even have to do that. Now the physicians are so in tune with the idea that their work is to help restore the patient to a state, a quality of life that enables them to function outside the hospital. And if they can't do that, then they should be thinking in terms of a good death or comfort care or palliation in a comfortable setting. In other words, they're already doing this kind of thinking. They don't need me. If I'm really good at this, I'll be talking myself out of a job.
Dr. Lawrence Schneiderman is a professor emeritus at the University of California, San Diego. I'm Laurel LeBoux. Thanks for listening to the Bioethics Channel.